Right. So, rights continued. We left off with rights this morning, and we're going to continue on. We spoke about the story where that poor woman was dragged into the crowd and threatened with death, just to prove a point. So, we spoke about the horror, and now we're going to continue on with the hypocrisy. Okay. So, the horror was about the woman in the story. The hypocrisy is about that group of men that had dragged her into that situation. Those religious leaders. They were actually right. I'm going to move this forward. I'm still not done, Mark. I'm still moving stuff around. Then I'm going to put that over there. Okay, now I'm done. Okay, so they were right. The law actually said that she was caught in adultery, and the law said that she should be stoned to death. Society at that time also said that women should be punished more severely and more often for this crime. Even if it was rape, they could still say that it was adultery and blame the woman. Even if it was by force or coercion. But who knows? Maybe this woman did commit adultery. Maybe she was in an arranged marriage and she fell in love. Maybe she was in an abusive marriage and she fell in love. But the fact is they were right. But why were they right? Why were they allowed to do this? And I think it was agreed collectively that it was to protect a woman's virtue. If they let her get away with this, then all women were in danger of losing their virtue. And isn't that just the linchpin of society? That it's a woman's duty and a woman's power to be the morality of the entire society. Well, there is a problem with this notion of, if you read that, woman's superior virtue and went, excuse me, like, that sounds a bit prideful. Well, it's more than that. It's up there for a reason. There's a problem with the notion of women's superior virtue, and the first is that it's a lie. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that women are inherently less sinful or less prone to sin than men are. Jesus died as much for our failings as he did for men's failings, and as much for our redemption as he did for men's redemption. We have the same feelings as men, and possibly a few more thrown in for good measure, thanks sometimes to hormones, or we're not going to lie here. Mm-hmm. So the myth that women are the keepers of society's morals, that's dangerous. And it leads to terrible consequences for women, but it leads to terrible consequences for men as well. As we saw in this story, these men, it turned them into hypocrites. It made them do terrible things. These actions that they did were terrible, and yet they were left to do them. They weren't called into account by society for it. I have worked alongside and with and in the trades pretty much all my life. My family are builders, and so I've always moved in and out of that sphere. So I've seen a lot, and I want us to workshop this because I want to know what we're going to call it. You know when a workman has pants and they don't always do the job, like, and they have to get down into small areas, and then it's revealing in a certain way. Anybody want to throw out a phrase that I can use? Is anybody brave? Slammer bomb. Is that what we're going to go with then? Okay, thank you. I didn't want to be the one to decide it, and I'm glad. I'm glad that somebody else offered that. So, if I had a dollar for every time that was in my line of sight. Because I've always moved in this sphere, but I've never seen anybody run up to one of these tradesmen with that double-sided tape that we use to stick our clothes to our bodies in case we might want to move at some point, and say, oh, I just want to do that for you for your own protection because you were sending the wrong message. That's never happened, and of course it sounds ridiculous. And why don't we do that? Because we tell ourselves that it's different for men. Because men are visual, and men are unable to control themselves. First of all, women have desires as well. we're quite capable of seeing something that we are attracted to. It's not usually the plumbers, but I'm sure we're quite capable. Secondly, who are these men? Who are these monsters that are running around that are so visual and they can't control themselves? It's not the men that I know. It's not the man that I've married, and it's certainly not the man that I am raising. Who are these men that we're not holding to account? There are many, many verses in the Bible about self-control. There are about 14 that use those exact words depending on the translation that you use. 1 Corinthians 7, 5-9. One of those sections. Now, this is writing to a married couple, not just one, like all married couples that were included in the church that the letter went to. It says, "Do not deprive each other of sexual relations unless you both agree." So, do not deprive each other unless you both agree to refrain from sexual intimacy for a limited time so you can give yourselves more completely to prayer. Afterwards, you should come together again so that Satan won't be able to tempt you because of your lack of self-control. That's referring to them both. All this situation includes, but Galatians says that self-control is a gift of the Spirit. 2 Timothy said that God did not give us a spirit of fear, but of power, of love. Sometimes it's a sound mind, I like that. Sometimes it's a self-control. I'm supposed to press click. There we go. Yeah, another problem with women's superior virtue is that it is dangerous. If we say to Christian men that they are visual creatures and they can't control themselves, if we say that as Christians, we need to remember that according to the book of Matthew, on two separate occasions, Jesus said that if your eyes cause you to sin in this way, you should gouge them out. That doesn't sound like a free pass to me. That sounds like accountability. That sounds like you have to take responsibility for how what you see affects you and what you do with it. It does not say if your eyes cause you to sin, you should run up to the problem with double-sided tape and a pashmina and make sure that it's all covered over. We're called to be accountable. Is modesty an issue? Yes. Yes, it absolutely is. And it's an issue for women. To empower women, it is not an issue whereby we're saving men through our modesty. We are all accountable for ourselves. I want you to consider as well those things that we spoke about this morning, about how these things can really have an impact on men as well, and how we're not doing them any favors. Just look at this group of men and the terrible things that they did because society backed them up and said, "You're right, she has to be held accountable. She holds our virtue, and we must make sure that we make an example of her." So, is it a compliment for men to say, and it sounded like a compliment for so long, for men to say that we're just more virtuous? Surely they are lifting us higher. Surely they are putting us in a position of power. Surely they are saying, "Listen, you might not be as strong as us, but boy, are you virtuous." And so you hold that, and it's a compliment. So I'm going to read now about Coventry Patmore's narrative poem. It's "The Angel in the House." It's perhaps best known of all the Victorian images of ideal womanhood. We get a lot of our notions now about what is virtuous in a woman from what was taught in the Victorian era. Those really did feed into our modern perception of what virtue was. Before that, it was actually quite different on a lot of fronts. Written to his wife, Padmore lauds the virtues of a dependent wife who maintains a domestic haven with little interest or activity in the larger world outside her home, her husband, and her children. her specific qualities of unselfish grace, gentleness, simplicity, and nobility reveal that she is not only a pattern Victorian lady, but also, literally, an angel on earth. Padmore's poem became a Victorian bestseller. So influential was the poem that one author notes that it became a convenient shorthand for the selfless paragon of all women, and were extorted to be enveloped in family life and seeking no identity beyond the roles of daughter, wife, and mother. Conduct books for this era stressed that girls' feminine virtues were of modesty, gracefulness, purity, delicacy, civility, complacency, reticence, chastity, affability, and politeness. In exchange for embracing this domestic role, a woman was promised security and protection. So it sounds good up until a point when you're told there's an exchange taking place here. That this isn't a case of these are the things that you naturally are bound to. It's a case of you have to do these things, otherwise you will not be protected and you will not be safe. It's not used, this notion of virtue is not used to give power to women, but as a form of control. Women became, in the Victorian era, physically weaker and measurably smaller due to lack of physical activity. You know, they weren't out there helping out, farming and doing all those kind of activities. They're restricted by corsets and impractical shoes. It is very hard to accomplish anything from the top of a pedestal. Women who refused to behave were told that they were outside of the security and the protection of society. That's why it's cruel. Like the woman that was dragged in front of this crowd, in front of Jesus. This notion, it gives the opportunity for men to act terribly with impunity, with the backing of society. These men, these religious men, Jesus knew something about them. I don't know what he knew. I want to know so badly what he was writing in the dirt. But he didn't tell us. There's a reason for that. I'm not even too sure what that reason is. But there is one detail that stands out on me, that they left the oldest first. That's one of those things I'm just going to leave hanging there because I'm not too sure what it means, but for some reason, I love that detail. I have a few thoughts about what it might mean. But when they left, when they really couldn't say to themselves, I am virtuous enough to throw this stone and end this woman's life. The oldest left first. I think that might be to their credit, actually. So, does equality mean that we hate men? No, we don't hate men. And I'm raising one. I'm raising a man. But I am raising him to believe that he cannot pass his own failings off as somebody else's failings or somebody else's fault, and that he cannot make somebody else weaker or less than him in order to do that. If we really want men to be strong, we need to demand more of them. More virtue, more self-control, more like Jesus. And this is the point that I've wanted to get to in this story. Now we get to focus on Jesus' part in this story. You see, so many others were more interested in having rights, in being right, than doing what was right. Self-righteousness in the place of righteousness. The law said that they could, society backed them up, and whatever these men had been doing, they were not held to account for it. Nobody was calling them out for it, so they got away with whatever they decided to do. But what was the right thing to do? Now, if this were a story that were happening now, this would be up for debate. And we would say, what was the right thing to do in this situation? Let's analyze everybody's part. Who was right? Who was wrong? Who did the right thing? But this is in the Bible and Jesus is in this story. So it's quite clear the right thing to do is exactly what Jesus did. We have it very plain for us. What is the right thing to do? It's what Jesus did. Now, talk about rights. Jesus had the right. Jesus was very God. He actually wrote the law that they were quoting. He had the right to demand punishment of this woman, of that crowd of men, of that entire crowd of spectators, of the entire world if he wanted to. But he didn't exercise those rights. He waived those rights. And he got down in the dirt. And he ignored the rules again. And he chose love again, just like he did on the cross. This was the point about some people being more interested in rights. This was the point about what was the right thing to do. I said I was going to be more disciplined with this. I really wasn't. This was the point about Jesus having the right to demand punishment. There. That's worth repeating, because it was beautiful. He doesn't exercise those rights. Jesus waives his rights. And this is what it was all about. We're talking about rights. And he tells us what to do with our rights when faced with a woman who was terrified, with a woman who needed mercy, with a woman who had done wrong, who wasn't perfect. So this is a definition of humanity. There's two sides to it. One form is that it's talking about the human race, collectively, all of us. The second is it's talking about benevolence, compassion, kindness, consideration, understanding. I want us to realize that there were so many humans in that situation. But God was there in the form of Jesus. And it took Jesus in this situation to teach us how to be human, how to show humanity. You put love first. That's how you do it. And it's not even a hidden truth. It's screamed throughout the Bible that the greatest of these is love. God is love. For God so loved the world. And Jesus wasn't only compassionate when it was convenient, and when it was acceptable, and when it was easy. Jesus practiced kindness in controversy, sympathy in amongst scandal. Jesus is always, always for the underdog. As a church, we find ourselves, especially in this part of the world, maybe more so in the southern states, we find ourselves in the majority with power and with wealth. So we have to attend more carefully to who Jesus is. If Jesus is for the underdog and we are no longer the underdog, we need to pay attention. As women, we should never turn on other women. We are stronger together and society is better off for it. That is our real duty and that is our real power. If we push her away, if we push her to the fringes of society, she is out of the realm of protection. And we have done that to her and we have put her in that danger. Even if we find her choices offensive, even if we find her actions shocking, or her beliefs completely to be opposite to our own beliefs, we must not abandon her. We must not abandon each other. It is not our duty to be society's morality, but it is all of our duty to protect our sisters, the ones we like, the ones we understand, the ones that we don't like, the ones that we don't understand. It is quite simply how Jesus would behave in the situation. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the reasons.